It worked for me. Almost everyone, sooner or later, feels like they got some blessed relief from a remedy of dubious value, something that's not supposed to work, something alternative and a bit pseudoscientific, something out of folk medicine from another time on the other side of the world. Maybe it was Epsom salts or homeopathic arnica cream. Maybe it was something a little more modern-seeming, like laser or shockwave therapy. There are many ways for treatments to seem effective when something else actually deserves the credit. But most people, even card-carrying skeptics, don't know about most of those ways. And so they are usually sure that the treatment worked. Science be damned. The number one rationalization for these apparent successes is this classic half-truth. But scientific trials show us the average response to a treatment. It may still work well for some people. It worked for me, after all. Or, probably more commonly, they say it works for some of my patients, because this idea is mostly floated by professionals rationalizing their clinical choices. This is the outlier gambit. It's often suspiciously extended into a rant against evidence-based medicine itself, scoffing about the futility of testing treatments at all. It's not entirely wrong, but most people try to put much more weight on it than it can support. I'm Paul Ingram of PainScience.com, and this is the PainSci Updates podcast. Today's episode digs into this very specific point. I've tackled many closely related topics over the years, but I've never gone exactly here, despite references to it going back 20 years. The most significant relevant writing I've done is a nerdy article called The Power of Barking, which is an odd title, based on a dog meme about correlation, causation, and how we think we know what works for us. If this episode interests you, that's some recommended reading after this. There's a further reading section at the end of the web version of the post, or just go to painscience.com/barking or Google Power of Barking. Okay, let's carry on with the outlier gambit. So the idea of strong responders isn't crazy. The results of trials can indeed fail to reveal significant benefits for a few people who actually do well with a treatment that's unimpressive for most others. And I should probably acknowledge this more often than I do. Trial conclusions mostly focus on the typical response to a treatment, and yes, sometimes the distribution of results shows high variance, and that spread does include a few genuine strong responders in the statistical good place. The clearest cases of important subgroups of people who respond much better than average are pharmacological, where known biology makes their existence much more plausible, if not almost a certainty. One of the all-time best examples comes from Yarnitsky et al., who showed in 2012 that patients with measurably poor endogenous pain inhibition, which is a testable glitch, not a guess, responded better to pain meds than patients without that problem. The response varied enormously depending on their measurable capacity for inhibition, a critical clinical reality that was just invisible in the average effect. So that subgroup is real, the predictor is measurable, and the mechanism makes sense. And no, unfortunately, we don't know why people have poor inhibition, which is very frustrating. We can detect it and measure it, but there are only guesses about how it works. A few examples like that are potent seeds of truth for the outlier gambit. Now, outliers may exist, but there are a lot of very big buts here, and I cannot lie. Variance cuts both ways. Variance itself varies, and sometimes the range of responses to a treatment isn't always wide, and sometimes it just doesn't reach far enough from the mediocre mean to include any strong responders, only meh responders or slightly better than nothing responders. It can also hide strong negative responders. Many, if not most, outliers in small trials are noise, not signal. That noise is already routinely mined for so-called positive results that are actually an illusion. They are routinely better explained by regression to the mean, natural recovery, reporting bias, co-interventions, and many other possible confounders, rather than a lucky treatment effect for a special few. Remember that trials routinely fail to effectively control for exactly the kinds of things that will produce meaningless outliers. A genuine benefit hiding in weak average results is usually rare or modest at best, or it would pull up the average. Unless it was confined to a mysterious subgroup, and such groups are rarer in physical medicine and manual therapy. In fact, good luck trying to find a single good example. One of the best candidates was a clinical prediction rule to identify which low back pain patients would respond best to manipulation, a treatment with modest average effects at best. This effort generated some real excitement, precisely because of the common optimism about the power of subgrouping and how it might validate a kajillion examples of, but it worked for me, regarding an extremely popular treatment. And then an independent team tested it, Hancock et al., and womp womp, no replication. The hope of an important subgroup, a signal strong enough for clear replication, evaporated on contact with fresh data. Bummer. No, really, it is a bummer. I'm not happy about this. I sincerely wish it had worked. Just like I truly wish there was a dinosaur hiding in a Scottish loch, because that would be really cool. There are quite a few other notable examples of failing to clearly identify clinically significant subgroups, which is why Raby et al. Wrote in 2019, quote, "While unidimensional subgrouping has been thought useful to guide treatment, it is unlikely to capture the full complexity of chronic low back pain." It's why Sargiotto et al. In 2017 concluded that the quest for outliers is, quote, "far from optimal and not yet ready to be implemented in clinical practice." And I can assure you, nothing important has changed since 2019 and 2017. Back pain, of course, is, as always, is a good proxy for all kinds of other research, because we've got quite a lot of back pain research. And if we can't get a clear signal about something out of back pain research, good luck getting it out of research about any other condition or treatment. And so the widespread enthusiasm for special cases is a kind of special pleading. It's what people propose in the conspicuous absence of validated subgroups. You probably aren't an outlier. Or if you're a clinician, your patients probably aren't outliers. If trial evidence is negative, or merely damns a treatment with faint praise, failing to impress, it's probably genuinely ineffective for most people most of the time. The exceptions do exist, and they are a legit reason for some cautious optimism. There are probably enough of them to justify trying some iffy treatments as long as they're relatively safe and cheap. But the exceptions mostly aren't important exceptions. Important treatment benefits rarely lurk in the statistics, and bad clinical trial news is mostly as bad as it seems. The outlier hope is no more a genuine win for healthcare than lotteries are a solution to poverty. Yes, some people win, but not many, and mostly not much. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.